welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When we ask, where does our food come from? Often we're thinking of the traditional farm scenario with silos and cows and beards on the corn stalks, not a garlic plantation in California, or the superstore that shuffles tons of produce every day, or the inner workings of the biggest sit-down chain restaurant in the world. Journalist Tracy McMillan decided that the way to find out how and why Americans eat the way they do, which is generally not so great, was to go to those places to consider not only what we buy, but how we buy and its relationship to what we earn. She wrote a book. The book is called The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. Tracy's with us right now. Welcome to the show, Tracy McMillan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
Question for our listeners. What is the single greatest factor that determines how you eat? Is it cost? Is it time? Is it tradition? Is it something else? Give us a call and tell us your story. 614-292-8513. So, Tracy McMillan, you begin the story by telling your own story about how you grew up eating, and it wasn't that pretty. So tell us about that.
Sure. So I grew up outside of Flint, Michigan, a little rural town, and, you know, it just sort of ended up that my mom got real sick and my dad was a lawnmower salesman. So we didn't have a ton of money. We were never straight up poor, but, you know, we didn't have a lot of time. My dad didn't know a lot about cooking. And we just, you know, we ate a lot of hamburger helper and tuna helper and mac and cheese and, you know, stuff where, you know, the food came in a box with directions on it and my dad could make it pretty easily. And, you know, it was really interesting for me to move to New York. I got a scholarship out here when I was 17 and ended up putting myself through school mostly by working for, affluent families as a nanny, as a cook, as a tutor. And all of a sudden, you know, I would talk to folks about the food that I had grown up eating, and they would find it funny and sort of, you know, I had this really interesting experience of realizing that, you know, the food that I had grown up eating wasn't considered good food. Initially as a kid, right, I was sort of like, well, yeah, it is really funny. And then the older I got, I sort of felt like, I don't know why that's funny. That's what was available in terms of time and money and access in my household. Like, why would that be hilarious? And you know, in a way, that's really what led me to do The American Way of Eating, is I just really wanted to have an excuse to sit down and study, you know, what shapes the way that we eat besides personal preference.
You also talk about traditions in your family, that there was a tradition of a certain kind of eating style that turned its nose up at other, maybe more highfalutin ways.
Yeah, you know, my family's pretty basic. You know, my dad sold lawnmowers. My grandparents were factory workers. We were kind of snobs about not being snobs. So it was a really horrible thing to look down on other people. And certainly when it came to food, right, fancy lettuce or a weird tomato or any of these things that sort of took a narrative approach to food, that was all something very alien and weird. And it was something that we reserved for like the sort of caricatured idea of the upper class, right? So it'd be sort of like, what was that show when I was a kid? Like Robin Leach's, like Homes of the Rich
Lifestyles
and Famous.
Of the Rich and Famous, right?
Right. So the idea would be that, well, if you were eating fine foods and caviar and high end lettuce, anything that, you know, wasn't sort of basic and at the grocery store that we went to, you know, you were sort of a snob that belonged in some rich house somewhere and didn't understand what life was like in the rest of the country. And so that was something I really carried with me for a long time. Particularly when I was in college and learning to feed myself. And it was really interesting for me to look back on that and say, okay, so right, I would act like, oh, I don't care about my food, whatever, it's fine, I'll eat anything. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, right, I would bake birthday cakes from scratch.
Yeah, right.
Right, and I would, you know, as a student, and I'm not proud of this, you know, I would shoplift spices from the A&P because I wanted to try making curries and spices were really expensive, mm-hmm. right? So that's not the behavior of somebody who doesn't care about food.
Well, interestingly, and you, of course, you did live in New York City, which is in some people's minds, you know, it's a food capital of the world or an eating capital of the world.
Yeah, well, and interestingly, you know, I moved to New York City in 1994, and so farmers markets weren't the same thing here at that time that they are now. I my dorm for a while was off Union Square. I had a scholarship to NYU. And, you know, I didn't really eat there. But, you know, because I ended up working for these really affluent families, you know, all of a sudden I got to see how people with money ate and what was different about that from the way I had eaten. You know, so all of a sudden, you know, every 4 nights a week I would sit down to dinner and we would have, you know, a nice little spring lettuce mix that we got from the store and fresh tomatoes and, you know, nice meat and things like that. Or we'd order really good takeout, you know, which is not, you know, I grew up takeout with pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really interesting thing for me because I sort of said, well, but maybe they're snobs, but this is really good. Like, why don't I get this in my neighborhood?
My guest is Tracy McMillan. We're talking about her new book. It's called The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. If you have a question or comment for Tracy, also we'd like to know what moves you to eat what you eat. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Critics compare your book to Barbara Ehrenreich's bestseller, Nickel and Dimed, on Not Getting By in America. Mm-hmm. And, I see the resemblance. She also goes undercover and writes about the overall living conditions of the working poor. You focus more on explaining why in a land of plenty, some people, even people with jobs, are eating crap instead of healthy food.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm obviously a big fan of Ehrenreich's mm-hmm. work, and that book was certainly an inspiration for mine. But I really wanted to get more into the texture of daily life and really get at this question, like, what's shaping the way people are eating besides the idea that, you know, good food is for snobs, or, you know, I like this or I like that. And, you know, I really felt like the only way I was going to be able to tell a compelling and honest story about what happens to your diet when time and money are at a premium would be if I went and I did some of those jobs for myself. And I really decided, you know, because there's such a fascination with the way we eat and where our food comes from and all of that, I thought that, you know, what would make it really interesting is if I went and I worked in the food system, and so I could get a handle on some of the internal logic within each part. So, you know, I went and I worked as a farm worker in California. I worked at Walmart in Michigan, and I worked at an Applebee's in New York City in the kitchen. And obviously, you know, I was only there for 2 months, and each job was mm-hmm. sort of the framework I was working with. But I, you know, was able to get a little bit of a sense of the internal logic. You know, certainly I didn't get any top secret documents out of it, but it was a really fun experience.
How did you decide where to go? Let's first talk about just Walmart and Applebee's, for example. What were the factors that went into that?
Right. So very simple. I just wanted to go to the biggest places feeding the U.S. I felt like there was a lot of discussion happening about these amazing small farm innovations and sustainable agriculture while we didn't really even understand the internal logic of the system we already had. So there was a lot of criticism of the system we have, but not a lot of sort of honest engagement with why it looks the way it does. So there was a lot of people saying, oh, it's subsidies and it's corporate, you know, malfeasance, and it's all these evil people making bad decisions that are against our best interests, which, you know, there's a grain of truth in that. But systems, you know, have their own internal logic. And for me, what was interesting is trying to understand that logic and see if there's a space to sort of intervene and make a few small changes that's better for everybody. And certainly, you know, I go back and forth about the right balance between government and market. But, you know, if you can leverage a market to give people healthy food, I think that's great. And so, I wanted to be able to play with that.
We mentioned off the air earlier that Rush Limbaugh had a heyday. I'm not sure he actually mentioned your name or not, but he trashed your book.
Oh, no, he mentioned my name. He named me. And he called me an authorette several times.
Authorette, yeah. He likes to do those little lectures. But so you have your critics out there that think you were sort of trashing Walmart and Applebee's, for instance, but others think you took a pretty balanced approach.
Yeah, well, you know, I take my job as a journalist really seriously to present an honest and fair accounting of what I see. So that doesn't mean, right, I don't have any opinions, mm-hmm. but you have to be fair about and sort of taking the other side's point of view and seeing what logic is reasonable. And so I really tried to do that. I do think, particularly because we're so divided politically and culturally right now, that for some folks, like the idea that there might be any problem with Walmart, It just tends to sort of make them feel very defensive. And certainly, you know, I run into a lot of people in New York. In fact, when I did my book launch event, I had a big panel of people together because I wanted to have a big discussion. And somebody from the audience said, oh, well, and you know, those people eat, all these people are eating at Walmart in the States. And somebody on my panel said, oh, those people who eat at Walmart, they're so, you know, something to the effect of they're so stupid, which I found really offensive, but was also really indicative, right, that they're do tend to be folks that live in a bit of a cultural bubble and just sort of instinctively sneer at this idea that people are eating at Walmart and, you know, they think people should sort of shop at farmers markets and things like that. And I love farmers markets, but, you know, farmers markets account for about 1 or 2% of our grocery sales in the U.S. and supermarkets account for about 80%. So for me, I'm much more interested in sort of how the 80% work. than in the 1 and 2%.
Did you get any pushback from Applebee's or Walmart about your reporting and about your book?
So neither Applebee's or Walmart reached out to me directly. It was pretty exciting for me. A few weeks ago, Applebee's announced a new ad campaign focused very heavily on how freshly prepared all of their food is, and several reporters, including folks at the Huffington Post, and I think some folks in Jersey covering food, pointed out that, you know, a lot of my work questioned how fresh their food was. You know, as you know from the book, you know, when I was working at Applebee's, most of the food that comes in, it's sort of like eating Hamburger Helper on a grand scale. So most of the dressings and sauces and soups are either powders that are reconstituted or they come in frozen in bags. Anything that goes into the deep fryer was prepared off-site at some factory somewhere and frozen and then gets dropped into the fryer. Meat and fish do come in as cuts of meat, but they're frozen and then defrosted. Mashed potatoes come in as whole potatoes, but they're, you know, those are steamed and then mashed with something called garlic milk, which is this white liquid that comes in a plastic bag. And so for me, it was really interesting to sort of say, oh, you know, I think of going out to eat at Applebee's as kind of a treat for working families. Now, it's certainly kind of expensive. It's really interesting to me that so little of this is better than what I could do at home with the freezer section at the grocery store.
Once again, if you're just joining us, my guest is Tracy McMillan. We're talking about her book on the American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. We'll return after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
World markets took a beating Monday, and the euro slid to a two-year low against the dollar. Amid the dizzying statistics, Walter Russell Mead argues the crisis rises beyond economics. Politically, he says, Turkey, Asia, NATO, the U.S., pretty much everybody's a loser. I'm Neil Cohn in the fallout from the euro crisis, plus Michel Flournoy on the president's foreign policy. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 until 4 here on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 82 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies. Partly cloudy skies throughout the day with a chance of an afternoon shower and a few scattered thunderstorms, a high rate around 86. The chance of rain decreases tonight, a low of 64 degrees. Isolated showers still possible for tomorrow, a little warmer with a high around 90. Cloudy skies tomorrow night, a low of 72. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Tracy McMillan. We're talking about her new book. It's called The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We'd like to know, what inspires your eating habits? How do you eat? Is it money? Is it tradition? Is it convenience? Tell us, 614-292-8513. Danielle in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Danielle.
Hi, good morning. Take my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if perhaps, I believe that most people tend to eat for convenience, and that might be their sort of leading factor in choices for food these days. And I wonder if that might be some sort of weird outmoded leftover biological imperative from when our species was struggling for survival. We would certainly pick out the weakest in the herd or the easiest fruit to pick off the tree, just as a matter of survival. And now it's sort of left over, and instead of picking the weakest in the herd, we're picking the easiest fast food joint to stop all that.
Well, Tracy, is there an anthropological backdrop to this?
So actually there is. So that's a really great question. I was really interested in some work done in this book called Catching Fire by a primatologist at Harvard University named Charles Wrangham. And in that book, he argues that evolution for humans was actually really tied to beginning to cook. So not just beginning to eat meat, but that once we learn how to cook, it changes the whole dynamic because you're suddenly able to spend, you know, about half an hour eating as opposed to 4 or 5 hours. Because if you're looking at the nearest primate relatives to humans, they spend like 5 hours a day just chewing, right? Because you have to digest all this roughage and you have to get all that into your body. So once you learn how to cook food so that you can digest it really quickly and you can begin to store it and keep it, right, it opens up the possibility to do really sophisticated hunting because the nearest relatives, you know, their longest hunt time is usually about 18 minutes, right, which is, I think of as like, you know, you're in the forest and you see something and you run after it and then you're sort of like, well, 15 minutes is up, I can't spend any more time on this because I need to go chew. and so there is this sort of beautiful synchronicity with the way that we look at eating now, because, you know, for people trying to survive in sort of the work life that we have in the U.S., you know, convenience is really important, not just because people are lazy, but because we work an incredible amount. And, you know, my background is actually as a welfare reporter, and I thought it was really interesting that we had begun to move all of these sort of low-income women that had been, you know, essentially raising families while collecting government benefits, and we push them into the workforce, and then we wonder why their diet is so bad.
Danielle, thanks for your call.
I just want to say that if you're getting criticism from Rush Limbaugh, you must be doing something right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Danielle. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to speak with our guest, Tracy McMillan. We're talking about her book, The American Way of Eating. Tracy, before we move on to some callers, I wanted to talk about the farm work you did in California Central Valley. It really seemed to take a toll on you. I didn't see it in your book because you didn't use pictures in the book, but you were damaged goods there for a while.
Yeah, so, and this is really common, you know, for folks in the working class in the U.S., right, because a lot of the work that they do is done with their bodies. So when I was working in the fields, the main problem that I still have is just that I have some residual tendonitis. So, you know, I had been cutting garlic, which is, you know, a forearm motion, and I got to the point where I couldn't really use my arm. And that's still a fairly tight part of my body, so, you know, I go and see a physical therapist for that every once in a while. And then I certainly feel like, but could not document, that my sinuses have not really recovered. I mean, even as a kid, I was sensitive to dust, and I think that spending, you know, 3 months in it didn't really help things. But interestingly, you know, so not only did I see a lot of farm workers wearing wrist braces, when I was working at Walmart, almost all of the women I met, even very young ones, had wrist braces or had carpal tunnel surgery. And there was this interesting moment of me saying, oh, right, because I generally have worked in an office and I went to college and I have all this opportunity, I think of carpal tunnel as this sort of like professional white-collar injury, but actually, you know, it happens all across the income spectrum.
Without necessarily the commensurate ability to fix it.
Yeah, definitely.
What about the idea of going undercover? Was it hard for you to do that, particularly when you're talking about these lower rungs on the ladder and how needy people were and how much they could have used your sophistication and intellect?
Right. Well, I really just felt like I needed to go undercover because otherwise you don't get an authentic work experience. I mean, and obviously there are a million things about me that set me apart from the workforce, particularly in the fields, and to a lesser degree in restaurants. I blend in pretty well at a rural Michigan Walmart. but, you know, bosses treat you really differently if they think that you are a reporter who has some power, as mm-hmm. opposed to if they think that you're just like a really broke white girl, which is pretty much how I was presenting myself, and which, you know, at different points in my life has been accurate. So I really felt, you know, that that was really important, and that I certainly have a better chance at making substantive change by using my role as a journalist than I have by, you know, trying to help individual folks with, you know, their specific problems. And to be honest, right, like, I'm a bright person. I've gotten an education, but I'm not necessarily that much brighter than farm workers. I might be a little more sophisticated. And so, you know, it's just I don't actually have that much more money or that much more intelligence. And particularly not within those specific subsets of the economy, right? Like, I needed as much help as anyone to figure out how to get ahead and support myself within the context of being a farm worker, as probably a farm worker would have needed to start to become a journalist.
Dina in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have been wanting to discuss this, and I think a lot of the food choices that Americans make and that we're faced with is related to the Farm Bill. As you probably know, and the Farm Bill is passed by Congress every 7 years, and it's what determines what crops the federal government will subsidize. And at this point, we're subsidizing heavily cash crops like corn and soybeans and wheat and cotton and even, I think, tobacco, and that I'd have to double-check the facts on. But, you know, my point is that it's more profitable for farmers to grow corn to raise beef, which is really environmentally completely unsustainable, and to grow soybean, et cetera, even corn for ethanol, than it is for farmers to grow really healthy, nutritious food crops like strawberries and tomatoes and broccoli, which is a big risk that farmers have to take. And so when your average American has to make their choices as to what they're going to purchase for their table, it's cheaper for them to buy spaghetti and for them to buy foods made with corn and potatoes than it is for them to buy all those healthy produce that we keep telling people to eat. But they tell me, I can't afford it, I can't afford it, I can't afford it. So at the outlay, it really is more expensive for them, and that's a result of our federal politics in large part.
Tracy McMillan, is the cost that much of a factor when it gets to the dinner table level?
The cost is certainly a problem for folks at the dinner table level, but also, right, a lot of this around convenience. And before I get into that, I do want to say, like, I do think federal agricultural policy is a big problem for us right now because it makes it so much easier to eat junk food than to eat healthy food. You know, I sort of came out of this project really feeling like, you know, we've made it really easy and affordable and accessible to get junk food, and we haven't done that with healthy food. And, you know, if it's super easy and cheap to get junk food and everybody's eating it, maybe we should look at making it easy for everybody to get healthy food, which doesn't really happen right now. In terms of cost at the dinner table, you know, people don't generally go shopping every single day for fresh fruits and vegetables, right? So if you're a working parent, say, like, you want to be able to go to the store and get stuff that won't go bad, right? So this is a big thing with fresh produce. If it rots, you've just wasted all of that money. And if you don't have a high level of kitchen literacy and really know how to cook, I mean, essentially without recipes, right? Because recipes are great to sort of make a special dish, but in terms of a day-to-day cooking practice, you kind of need to be able to cook with just what you have and use it up. And most people don't have that level of kitchen literacy. You know, fruits and vegetables are more expensive per calorie than junk food. At the same time, you know, having spent, you know, all these periods working and making, for the most part, minimum wage. As a farm worker, I made significantly less than minimum wage and get into that in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, I was able to eat fairly healthfully. But it also, you know, I do think George Orwell does this beautiful job in The Road to Wigan Pier where he says, you know, when you are broke, you do not want to eat something healthy and wholesome because the only luxury you can afford, right, is something sort of sweet and junk. And he doesn't say junk food because that mm-hmm. wasn't the rhetoric at the time. But, you know, when everything else in your life is sort of beating you down and you have no agency and you're working really hard but your life isn't necessarily improving, it's sort of a really high bar to expect people then to be like, and you know what, I'm going to spend a lot of time and energy and money and be really proactive about my diet, right? That's just not how psychology works. And so I feel like, you know, it's been interesting to sort of look and see how that all works together.
Dina, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye. Take care.
Thanks, Dina.
We have an email from Cynthia in Columbus. She says, the food I grew up on was made from scratch by mom, and what I have consumed for the past 40-plus years is determined by how nutritious it is. Even when eating out, I consider the fat and salt content. I rarely purchase boxed food at the grocery store because it is so loaded with too much salt, fat, and additives, and homemade food tastes so much better. Also, I grow lettuce and tomatoes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's great, right, when people have that agency and take that very seriously, but we haven't tended to have a food culture that encourages people to do that, and I think it's really important to sort of look at how people make decisions, and I sort of came out of this project saying, you know, we make it really difficult for people to eat well, and we argue that, you know, we should spend more money on the food, or we should spend more time, or we should spend more energy. And for me, I'm sort of like, you know, we've been lecturing people to eat their fruits and vegetables at least as long as I've been alive, and that hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we need to figure out something besides telling people what to do and figure out how to make it easier for them to make good decisions.
Getting to Walmart and your experience there a little bit, it's supposed to be famous for maximizing profit,
mm-hmm.
You point out, but you saw a lot of waste there, at least where you worked in the produce section.
Right. Well, and most produce sections, right, are going to have a lot of waste,
sure.
because stuff is dying off, right, the whole time. But it was very interesting for me to sort of show up at this store outside of Detroit and realize that, you know, the produce section, which was, you know, one of two produce sections in the town that I was in, was managed by a 20-year-old kid who didn't know anything about produce. And so, you know, I write about this in the book. I had a day where I threw out literally 200 pounds of asparagus that had rotted in the cooler and had been sitting there for over a month. Right, so it's this sort of comedy of errors where I took out one box of asparagus to put it on the floor, and I sort of was like, oh, look, this bunch is moldy. Oh, this bunch is moldy. And this one, oh, gosh, this whole box, oh, it must be this one box. And then, you know, every subsequent box was moldy. And I really came to feel like, you know, this is a real indication that when you have a retailer whose experience is giant economies of scale with retail products, you know, that do not rot, right, which is a very different thing from produce, they might not necessarily appreciate that there's a real difference with produce and with fresh foods. You know, it's one thing to work. I worked in the grocery section also for a little bit, which is where there's all the processed food. And on that stuff, like Walmart can compete really highly. I would argue about the quality because I did a little bit of sort of spot checking on quality of some of the processed stuff and wasn't as impressed with it as I would have hoped. But, you know, if you are treating, you know, apples and lettuce as if they are sneakers, you just end up throwing out a lot of it. And to me, that was really striking.
Any impressions about Walmart's dedication to using up the surplus by giving it to food banks or anything like that?
I mean, that's great. I'm certainly a fan of Walmart donating food instead of throwing it away. But interestingly, you know, I worked at this Walmart that wasn't particularly well run in the produce section, and there was a leak in the cooler for pretty much the entire first month I was there. So there, you know, in the big walk-in cooler, there were two buckets set on the floor that were perpetually overflowing. The floor was always slick and puddled, and so we had a real problem with moisture in the back room. And so we had an entire shipment of corn on the cob that just molded over. And so this is stuff mostly on the tassel end, right? It was stuff that, you know, if it was in my kitchen, I probably would have still eaten it. And to me, it was really striking that Walmart dedicated a lot of time and energy in terms of us workers in the department stripping that corn down so that we could then send it to the food bank, right? Because part of me, you know, the sort of egalitarian in me wanted to say, like, I don't think we should send moldy corn to the food bank. But, you know, certainly, we waste so much food in the U.S. I think anything that we can do to sort of make sure we distribute it and use it is really important.
An observation that Rush Limbaugh made that I thought was interesting was the idea that, hey, we give these people cheap food via Walmart, inexpensive maybe is the better, and they also expect it to be good quality?
Yeah, I think that was probably the most, other than getting called an overeducated woman, I think that was the most offensive
authorette
thing. Yeah, I had heard in Rush Limbaugh's discussion of my book because, you know, I really don't think that, you know, low-income people should have crappy food. You know, do they need to have caviar? Like, no. But everyone should have good quality, healthy food. That's important to life. That's important to health. We spend a lot of public money taking care of people with diabetes and heart disease and all these diet-related diseases. And there's a huge vested interest in having a workforce that can perform, having people. I mean, you know, there's this problem where something like a fifth of young people are too overweight to even qualify for the Army anymore. You know, we need to have a healthy population. There's all these very important reasons that we need that, not just some sort of aesthetic one. And the idea that, you know, low-income people should just get crap and that you should, you know, only get healthy food if you're affluent, to me, is just incredibly offensive and very un-American, right? One of the things I love about my country is that, you know, all men are created equal. And if we're all created equal, I feel like we all deserve to have, like, equally healthy food.
Robert in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
I just happened to be scanning the channels and caught this particular show, and it just has me spellbound.
Good.
The subject matter is so pertinent to me.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
And plus, I wonder how much time Tracy has invested of her life getting this data and whatnot, because I found that you look very youthful from your photo.
Well, that's just a really good photo.
I was just wondering what age she is, and that's not my central question. That's not just a curiosity thing there, but my central question is, does she really think restaurants, because I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, and different chains such as Applebee's, Old Charlie's, TGIF, Fridays, and along those lines, does she think they purposely practice deceit in terms of the quality and the cleanliness of their food, just the general preparation, but particularly the quality of the food? Are they purposely trying to deceive those who visit the restaurant?
Right. So I'll address the first one, which is that I'm 35, and I spent about 3 years working on this particular project. So that's quick and easy. And in terms of, and thank you for saying I look young. That was very flattering. And in terms of restaurants, I don't know that they're, I don't really think that there's a conspiracy here to defraud and deceive customers. I do think that because so much of the way restaurants work is, and particularly chains that are keeping food prices down by centralizing logistics and using a lot of processed food, you do see people cutting corners just because you don't want to throw away food, you don't want to increase your food costs. So, you know, for instance, at the Applebee's I worked at, you know, there's a very regimented system for dating food that's been prepared and when you save it and when you can throw it out. And, you know, I did a couple of shifts in the prep kitchen, and, you know, the line cooks would just come back to me with food that was expired from their cooler, and they'd say, could you redate this? Because I don't want to throw it out. I'm like, well, Applebee's has a system where it's supposed to be thrown out yesterday. It was made 3 days ago. They're like, yeah, it'll be fine.
Well, what's the percentage for them to not throw it out? What do they care?
Right. I mean, because I was only there for a couple months, I don't really have a good sense of what their internal logic is with that stuff. But it was really striking to me to sort of see how rationalized that stuff, and just sort of that there wasn't any attention really to the idea that, you know, you don't want to serve food that's rotten. It was sort of more like, well, we think we can get away with this, and then we don't have to increase our food costs. And I go back and forth, right, because you want food to be affordable. You want a business to run well. Would I probably eat that rice if it was in my fridge? Yeah. But is that what a customer is paying? You know, if a customer is paying $17, $18 for an entree with rice, I like to think that you would give them fresh rice.
Robert, thanks for your call. Where are you going to eat today for lunch?
Mine are interjectors. I was wondering, my thing, in my experiences with restaurants, first thing, I'm really a stickler for cleanliness. That's probably major, equal, or even above the quality of food, the fact that those preparing my food, if they're going to be clean when they're doing it.
Right. I mean, so, the one thing I can tell you is that because of the way the reporting broke down in my book, I worked in the field, I worked at Walmart for a little bit, then I worked at Applebee's, and I worked at Walmart again. At the end of the reporting part of the project. And that last period of working at Walmart when I was working in produce was the only time I was given a food safety training. So I didn't get any of that training at Applebee's. I didn't get it when I was working in the fields. When I worked in the fields, I was actually given a piece of paper to sign saying I had taken food safety training and never had. And at Applebee's, you know, it just sort of slowly dawned on me over time through getting sort of questionnaires and quizzes and things like that, that I was like, I don't really know anything about food safety and food cleanliness. And that's weird, right? Because I'm working on the line. Shouldn't I know? And then, you know, at the very end, I got given sort of a test when corporate came in. I was like, oh, I really was supposed to know this stuff.
But no one ever taught you. Robert, thanks for your call. My guest is Tracy McMillan. She's an author and journalist. We're talking about her new book. It's called The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farmfields, and the Dinner Table. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to join the conversation. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Wade Goodwin. Coming up on the next On Point, given that the country is awash with guns, is there even a debate to be had about gun control? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
An On Point is this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, join us for Hour 2 of All Sides, and it's Tech Tuesday, a discussion of social media and crime, cameras, and smartphone cameras, along with gadgetry. Join us for Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And you can always listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher online at WOSU.org/allsides. There you can find a live stream of audio and video weekdays from 10 until noon. Also, explore the All Sides archive, which includes audio and video of every show. That's at WOSU.org/allsides. Scattered showers and thunderstorms in downtown Columbus, 78 degrees. Cloudy skies today with that chance of rain and a high of 87. A less chance of rain for tonight, a low of 64 degrees. Still some isolated showers possible for tomorrow and a high of 90. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Tracy McMillan. We're talking about her book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farmfields, and the Dinner Table. What affects how you eat out there? Give us a call and tell us, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page. What is it in your life, your lifestyle, that dictates mostly what you eat? Tracy McMillan, I have an email here from Sarah. She writes, I grew up in the suburbs eating in the way the author described at the beginning of the show. Lots of hamburger helper and chicken veggie meals in a bag. There were only chain restaurants nearby, no locally owned places. My dad always called all of those places TGI Apple Garden because he said they are all essentially the same. This discussion is reminding me of that. Now I live in the city and there are lots of local places, and that is where I take my parents to eat out. They love it. That's a new one, TGI Apple Garden.
That's really funny.
What did you do in order to not just write your story and your experience, but also get into the stories and experiences of the other people around you who are really living in these situations day to day?
Right. So, I mean, like any reporter, right, I just pay attention and certainly talked and befriended people. And I did that, you know, the same way I would if that was really my life. You know, I didn't make up a different job or a different life to tell people, different jobs in my past or different family or friends or any of that. You know, I just conspicuously left out that I'm a journalist. But, you know, I have a lot of experience outside of that and was able to talk with folks that way. In a lot of ways, I sort of developed the strongest relationship when I was working in the fields in California. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was just because I was in a very vulnerable position and people really wanted to help me. And I think that has something to do with my race and certainly with my gender.
Because you stood out.
I really stood out because, you know, I would sort of get asked, you know, why don't you go work in a store? Don't you want to go work in a store? And I would just sort of say in my very, you know, not good Spanish, I'd say, you know, I don't want to work in a store. I have a lot of problems right now with my family, with my life, and I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to deal with customers and have to be nice to people. I just want to work hard. And if I can make minimum wage here, that is okay with me. And, you know, people sort of looked askance at me, but after you sort of have shown up 3, 4, or 5 days in a row, they sort of go, well, that must just be a very broke white girl. And people really, particularly middle-aged women, really seemed like they wanted to help me. And that was, for me, was a really powerful experience to see that. And some of this, right, I think also gets back to really just sort of my history. You know, I lost my mom when I was a kid, so there's probably a degree to which, like, I just project this thing of being like, I'm like, I have no mom. And you know, as Robert mentioned, right, I can pass for fairly young. So people were really shocked when they would hear that I was in my 30s.
I thought it's interesting they say, why don't you work in a store? In other words, most of them couldn't.
Right. So almost everybody I worked with in California were undocumented immigrants. And there was a very real sense that, you know, if you have another choice, you will work in a real job, right, with formal wages and all of that, because we were all being paid piece rate for the work that we were doing. And then we were never brought up to minimum wage. So, you know, my first day in Garlic, I picked 10 buckets of garlic. I got $1.60 for each bucket. And I was there for 9 hours, and I was paid $16.
But the law says they're supposed to, just like with waitressing, they're supposed to
right.
then bring
you
it up to.
You still have to make a minimum wage.
At least minimum wage.
You have to make at least minimum wage. And what would happen is the company would take my sort of time card from the day, and they would say, oh, 10 buckets, $1.60, $16. If we were paying her minimum wage, that would have been 2 hours. So my check, which would be a Social Security number check and have FICA and Social Security, all that stuff taken out of it, would say that I had been there for 2 hours.
That's a pretty big company. This was the Garlic Company, right?
Right. So, I was working for a farm labor contracting company.
Uh-huh.
And so this is the way a lot of harvest labor works out in California and actually around the country, is that the actual farmers rarely, particularly at larger operations, rarely actually hire the harvest crews themselves. What they do is they find somebody to sort of deal with all of the paperwork and all of the legal responsibility for those workers and sort of have them handle that. So it's sort of what, you know, a place like Foxconn does for Apple, sort of over in Asia or something like that. So you have a farm labor contractor, gets all the workers, brings them, delivers them to the field for the Garlic Company, and then harvest the garlic. So I wasn't ever working for the Garlic Company directly or for Christopher Ranch, which was the other company that we were picking for. You know, but certainly, you know, the work that I did benefited their company.
Email from Alex writes, my many favorite food traditions arose out of tough financial situations. For example, our family boils bones to make soup stock, or beans and rice are traditional because they're cheap.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting, right, because there's definitely a strain within the food world of really celebrating, I think they call it cocina pobre, right, like poor people's food, because that stuff was born of necessity. And so it's interesting because you can see, you know, that people, even people without much money, care a lot about their food, right? That's how you get these traditions developing around really simple food. You know, the question is, you know, like, do you want people to have good quality food and good health? And this is a problem we've always had in our republic. So even back in the 1780s, Thomas Jefferson was writing in Notes from Virginia about sort of food and agriculture in his state. And he said, you know, this is a paraphrase, you know, he said, you know, the wealthy raise vegetables and eat that, and that's necessary for health. And the poor mostly eat milk and meat. And that's inexcusable, right? So even that far back in our nation's history, you know, people have understood that healthy food is very close to being a human right.
This is a message from Troy on Facebook, and I'm interested in it because it kind of brings up the issue of food literacy. He says, this discussion really hits home. I can relate to your guest's father. I'm trying to do better for my daughter, but it's an uphill battle. I find that the process of effective shopping is extremely time-consuming. I noticed that families with a stay-at-home parent can find better food for less money, but they spend a huge amount of time shopping and finding the good deals.
Right. And this is a huge thing. And, you know, I sort of, sometimes I have little daydream moments where I'm like, you know, what would be awesome is if there was some sort of crowdsourced price comparison, you know, application for smartphones or something. Because interestingly, you know, when I was doing all of the actual reporting for the book, I did not go on food stamps. I felt like that would, A, sort of undercut the point of the book, which was to see what happens when you're working and earning wages and what you can do with what you earn. And at the same time, when I finished doing the reporting, I ended up sort of not really having enough money to support myself while finishing the book, right, because my advance just wasn't big enough. So I ended up going on food stamps, and I was living in Detroit for a bit. And so I ended up just, you know, I had no money, but I had some control over my time, particularly because I'm a single person. And so I started, you know, tracking what prices were for things. And I had like a little sheet of paper where I would, you know, walk around the big farmer's market there and write down the cost of sweet potatoes, you know, in the different sheds and figure out where was the cheapest sweet potatoes and bulk items that I would buy in different parts of the city, right? I would sort of write down, like, you know, how much is jasmine rice at the bulk place, at the Asian market, at this other store and things like that. But that's something that takes a lot of time and energy. And so, I think a lot of parents certainly feel like, you know, you have to cut the corner somewhere. And, you know, this is one of the things that makes Walmart so powerful for folks, right? Because you can just go and take care of all your shopping and be done with it. Mm-hmm. And you might be paying more money for things. And certainly Walmart is not always cheapest on price, but it wins at convenience because you can basically get every basic item you need in the one store.
Email from Frank. He says, I just want to commend your guest. It always drives me insane when people say Americans are addicted to fast food. It is hard to eat healthy. We don't all have time to go to the store every other day or the money to spend on fresh food. It's nice to see someone not blaming me for not having the advantages reserved for more advantaged people.
Well, that's basically what sent me out to do that project. You know, I like to tell this story that I sat down with an agent to talk about doing a book project, and initially I was talking about doing something about supermarkets. She said, wait, what are you really interested in? And I said, well, somebody has to get these foodies to be more reasonable because they're making it seem like eating well is only something that you can do if you have a lot of money and you're really snobby about it, and that's really stupid. Right. And I sort of went on this little rant, and she said, okay, this we can work with. Right. And so now I have this project.
And you've been interviewed by Bon Appetit magazine, yeah, for that matter. Donald in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes. I care not to eat monosodium glutamate.
MSG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how you do that in a restaurant.
I have no idea. Right. And interestingly, right, even though I was working at Applebee's and working in the prep kitchen, I really don't know what was in any of the food, right? There's not ingredients on all the boxes and stuff that come in. You know, here in New York, you do have to put the calorie count for food on the menu. And so that is something you have some control and knowledge over. But in terms of the constituent ingredients, like, nobody knows outside of sort of top-level restaurant folks.
Thank you, Donald, for the call. Mary Lee in Groveport, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mary Lee.
Thank you for taking my call. I find it interesting because I'm almost parallel to my mom. She would stay at home, and we knew that there were going to be three meals on the table every day, and it was mostly homegrown. We lived in the city, and they had their garden in the backyard. Every fall, we had put up tomatoes, peaches, green beans.
Mm.
So we learned how to, and she could stretch a dollar further than anyone I've ever known. And she's 89. She's still cooks, and she makes huge casseroles. So I think it's time resource management. She was at home. She could do that. I grew up single mom. I didn't have that. I think you got to get back to the basics, and you can educate your children. My daughter's a working mother, single. She has educated her kids to know that, you know, when we put a meal on the table, you've got to eat it. And they have learned that there's, you know, they go to the grocery store. They don't buy any extras or anything that's sweet or candy or pop or anything like that. They don't have that. That's not in their diet. It wasn't in my diet either. I think it boils down to time, resource management, and educating your kids that, you know, these are the healthier foods. My kids, my grandkids, they've all they've grown up to appreciate how my mom started cooking. You know, you eat what's on the table. If we have bean soup, cornbread, greens, it's a well-balanced diet. Didn't have a lot of desserts. Never had pop. Never had. That was a treat if we ever had it. But as we know, it's not, you know, beneficial to you anyway. But I think it all, you know, boils down to time resource management. You've got time. You can prepare a meal. And you can educate your kids that these are the things that you should eat, and it's not about fast food.
Right. Well, you know, one thing that really struck me in doing the reporting for this book was really coming to appreciate how much sort of kitchen skill we've lost. Because, you know, a lot of what you're talking about, like, really, you need to know how to cook well and quickly and not have to think about it very much. And that's something that, you know, working moms didn't just have to really struggle with that when they entered the workforce in the 70s, but they then lost a lot of the time, right, to be able to teach that to kids.
Exactly.
And there's this really interesting thing where I had talked with a woman who works at a women, infants, and children sort of public health center in Harlem, and she works with a lot of really new immigrants, and she said, you know, one of the things that she has to work with them on is to get them to understand that food could make you sick. Right, that something being sold as food in the store could make you sick if you keep eating it, because that is not a natural thing.
Exactly.
Right? And so I think that there's this moment in our food history, probably in the 70s, right, where why would food ever make you sick? It never had before, and so why would it matter if you were having more processed food? Food is food, right?
And it's more expensive.
And it's more expensive, right?
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's interesting. And also, when I was living with the farm worker families in California, you know, one thing that really struck me is I would go to the food pantry with them, and I would sort of get my own donations as well and share what could be shared with the families and whatnot. But when we would come back, like, we'd usually get, you know, some cookies or something like that. There would be some sweet thing from the food pantry. And the little kids in the family wouldn't go for the cookies. They would go for the fruit, right? And kids, like this idea that kids naturally only want junk food, I think is something that we have to sort of engage with and be like, well, really? What if people just learn to appreciate, like, good fresh food?
Gee, what if? You talk about that in your book. Tracy McMillan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tracy McMillan, she's the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.